Hello again. My name is Anna DeVries. I'm investigating two suspects in a series of unsolved crimes across North America. This podcast was released on the dark web to a dedicated viewership of 40 listeners. I'm re-releasing it here to involve you, the public. If you have any information about the hosts, their criminal networks, or the incidents discussed in the program, write to me at lookoutpod@gmail.com. They were last seen at a rest stop on I-80 in Iowa. Be on the lookout.
Welcome to our creepy little pit of despair. I'm Ronnie, and this is Connie.
Hello.
And we are here to delight you with our dazzling display of decrepitude and depravity.
Our story tonight is called The Angler.
A story so foul, you're going to wonder who farted.
But first, a word from our sponsors. And today we welcome a new sponsor, Melvin's Honey Hole. Melvin's Honey Hole specializes in flavorless, non-traceable poisons, dermal contact intoxicants, and that old-timey saltwater taffy. When it comes to sweets, Melvin's can't be beat. Promo code, ooh, I'm sticky.
And back by popular demand is Junius Coca Plum's 2-for-1, oopsies, I've made a mess. Use the promo code, spilt milk. And once again, we'd like to thank one of our most steadfast sponsors, Santorini's Funeral Parlor. At Santorini's, we can repair the most heinous of bodily damage. Take a mangled, bludgeoned, slashed and beaten pile of meat, and we'll make that corpse look good. Good enough to take out to a steak dinner. We've been making the dead look like world-class models for 76 years. We even have group rates for stag weekends and auto dealer conferences. When you're in a pinch, Santorini's makes it a cinch. Remember to call Santorini's hotline, 1-500-CADAVERS. We are in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, staying at an Airbnb in the Czech Village near the Czech Slovak Museum. Just kidding. I'm sure the coppers would love an exact location. Next time I'll give a GPS coordinate. Today we're at an undisclosed location in the Driftless area of northeastern Iowa, a region known for its craft beers and blue ribbon trout streams.
And what brings us here today, Ronnie?
We're here because on October 11th, 2004, the Iowa State Police were called to a cabin in the woods, half an hour drive from Decorah, Iowa.
They were alerted to the situation at the cabin by a FedEx driver. The driver was attempting to deliver a brand new wood-burning stove for the Woodley family, but the delivery required a signature, and he couldn't catch them at home. The driver had been to the cabin several days prior, but no one had answered. Ed Phelps was sick and tired of lugging around that stove. It was early fall and unseasonably warm. He was determined to get his signature and be free of the cumbersome box blocking up his truck. He knocked hard and fast, peering into the window for any sign of the homeowner. The front door led into a kitchen with an open floor plan, which led into the living room. That's when Ed noticed someone laying face down on the carpet. From his vantage, he couldn't tell what condition the person was in, though he feared the worst. Police arrived at the residence at 2 p.m. and broke the door down. In the living room, they found an adult male prone on the floor. They turned him over and knew immediately he was dead. His face was discolored a dark purple, indicating that he had died at that spot and remained there until he was found. The transcripts of calls from police and EMTs indicate that they suspected no foul play. The deceased was an older man in his 60s, and the assumption was he died of natural causes. That is, until they found body number 2. For whatever reason, it took police several hours before they explored the rest of the house, and to their surprise, in the master bedroom, they found a woman, 60s, laying dead on the bare mattress. Again, there was no sign of injury and no indication that they were drug users, but that would be left to the medical examiner. They checked the medicine cabinets for prescriptions and found the usual collection of over-the-counter pain medicines, antihistamines, and cough suppressants, in addition to medicine for high blood pressure and high cholesterol. The victims were Mark and Shireen Woodley, married. They lived full-time in Des Moines, but often visited their backwoods cabin when the weather was nice. Friends said that they were bookworms and liked to decompress by lounging under the shade of their old-growth oak trees to read a spy thriller or a romance novel. They had no kids or close relatives and left behind a rented apartment and two cats in Des Moines. It would be a week before the medical examiner came to a conclusion on the cause of death. Terminal dehydration, she wrote on both reports. Suicide by depriving oneself of water. This was the most likely cause. According to the medical examiner, death by dehydration is typically the consequence of an emergency, like when a hiker becomes disoriented and lost in the woods, or the result of severe child abuse, an infant or toddler being deprived of food and water. There are diseases that make it difficult or impossible for a person to drink water. For instance, late-stage rabies causes the infected person to be repulsed by water so that the virus becomes more concentrated in the saliva. Or late-stage dementia, where a patient loses their swallow reflex, but at that point in an illness, they're usually in a hospital or a nursing home with intravenous fluids, so severe dehydration is far less likely. This was certainly an uncommon method of ending one's life, especially for two people simultaneously. So the sheriff's office sent investigators back to the cabin to take a closer look. The Woodley cabin, in general, was quite tidy. The crime scene investigators searched under beds and in drawers and cabinets for a journal or a note, anything that might give a clue to the couple's mental state before their death. There were no computers found inside the house. Friends said the cabin was used by the Woodleys as a reprieve from the pressures of modern life. Cell phones were recovered, but no concerning text messages were discovered. However, both phones had a dozen or so failed calls over the span of 2 days, the last of which was made 72 hours before the bodies were discovered. The cabin was, after all, out of cell service, and there was no landline. None of the attempted calls were made to 911 or other emergency services. The attempted calls were matched to friends and family of the Woodleys. When investigators checked in with these contacts, they found that no one had expected the call or received a call. Upon their return to the cabin, investigators tested the kitchen sink. It was turned off. They tried the bathroom sink. It wouldn't work either. And the toilet was bone dry, the bowl and the tank. The water line was in the crawl space below the house, but that was turned on. They checked the water tank in the backyard, but it was 3/4 full. Upon further investigation, they found that the PEX hose that went from the tank to the house had been kinked and bound with paracord, stopping its water flow completely. These were interesting clues, but they still didn't answer the most important question. They knew definitively how they died, but they didn't know why they died. So what was the most plausible hypothesis? Investigators believe that they turned the water off themselves to stick to their plan, without the temptation of a quick gulp from the tap. But if we're to throw out that theory completely, what if they were stranded at the house with no water after the old man tried to fix a pipe and made it worse? Maybe their car had broken down, they were older, it'd be too far of a walk to the nearest town. So the investigators, they located the keys to the car and tested out this theory. The engine started right away. And just to be sure, they drove it up and down the driveway a few times. No problem at all. So the investigation settled on terminal dehydration, just like the medical examiner had suspected. We wouldn't have looked closer at this story if there wasn't a similar event half an hour away in the town of Meadows, Iowa. A family of four, mother Mary Jean Peterson, father Robert Peterson, their 14-year-old daughter Margaret, and 10-year-old son Christopher, were found dead at their vacation property. All four had suffered severe dehydration. That much was clear from the autopsies. However, only three had died of dehydration. Mary Jean, Margaret, and Christopher were found dead inside the cabin, but Father Robert was found outside. This vacation home, like the Woodleys, was also an isolated cabin. Cell reception was non-existent. It had been built so that its inhabitants could commune with nature, right next to a crystalline, blue-ribbon trout stream. According to family, Robert Pearson was an avid fly fisherman, and had always dreamed of owning a cabin where he could walk out his back door, and within 100 paces, be knee-deep in a trout stream. They'd bought the cabin 2 years prior from a foreclosure auction, renovated it, and made it their weekend getaway. Police discovered that the water line had been severed. Likewise, their telephone wire had been cut. But unlike the Woodleys, the Pearson case quickly turned into a homicide investigation. This is because the father, Robert, though dangerously dehydrated, had not died from thirst. Robert's cause of death, which was clear to anyone processing the scene and later confirmed by the medical examiner, was drowning. He was found sprawled on the rocky shore beside the stream, his head submerged in water. At that section of the stream, and during that time of year, the water is only a few feet deep. The toxicology report found a low dosage of antidepressants in his bloodstream, but no drugs that would suggest accidental drowning due to intoxication. There was damage to Robert Pearson's face, broken cartilage in the nose, bruising, damage to the eyes, but it is unclear if the jostling of the stream caused this post-mortem. Did someone force his face underwater? Were those injuries the result of a struggle? Like the Woodleys, the cell phones recovered from the house had failed calls, three of which were to 911. Their sedan was found in the annex garage, and it was operable, though the garage door was barred and locked, and the side door had the key broken off in the deadbolt. Who or what could have done this to a whole family? Turned the water off to the house and scared them so badly that they died of thirst? Had the father attempted to make a break for the stream when he thought the coast was clear, thinking finally that they were safe from whatever lurked outside? There have been a few cases of people dying from exposure hiding from aggressive animals, bear, moose, mountain lion, but there are no apex predators in Iowa, except one, humans. Were the Woodleys and the Petersons connected, or was this coincidental? We looked into cases of terminal dehydration in neighboring states, and found that an hour and a half from the Woodleys, across the border into Minnesota, Jackson Green, 31, and Sophia Chang, 29, a couple that had been living off the grid, were found dead by a friend in their custom yurt. This friend had been visiting for a scheduled stay, and when he found them, they had been dead for over a month. The bodies were badly decomposed, but the autopsy was still able to reveal that there was damage to the kidneys, and an analysis of the vitreous fluid of the eyes confirmed that severe dehydration was likely a contributor to their demise. The friend who discovered Jackson and Sophia's bodies told police that the pair kept a portable GPS navigation device inside their yurt, and that device would have been able to make emergency calls and text messages. However, police were never able to recover said device. Other than dehydration, what connects Jackson and Sophia to the other two cases was a stream not far from their campsite. Who or what killed these people? How could they have been scared so bad they sooner die of dehydration than confront this adversary? One thing that's noted in the police report of the Woodleys and the Petersons case was that a fly fisherman was seen making his way upstream, casting into the riffles behind the house. Other than the roads, the riverbeds are the only areas of traffic in these parts. These blue ribbon streams are celebrated by the sporting community for their fishing opportunities. Those fishing will walk upstream in waterproof waders looking for holdouts of trout and smallmouth bass. Who better to surveil these cabins than someone fishing? They can remain for hours in plain sight and not arouse suspicion. These streams pass through many a property, the waterways cannot be owned, and as long as the fly fishing stays in the water, it's not considered trespassing. A bonus for the killer, if this is their MO, is that any footprints or other identifying evidence will disappear almost immediately under the constant movements of the water. They can park far away, walk upstream, and watch without anyone growing suspicious. In both cases, a person was seen near the crime scene fishing and was subsequently interviewed. Different names in each report, but the phone number in each case has a Utah area code, and in both cases, that phone number is no longer working. One question we have is how long were the families in their cabins with the water turned off? It can take as long as 10 days to die of thirst. If there was some water left in the pipes and in the toilet, maybe longer, unless the water was turned off prior to their arrival. In this case, only the anglers would know if the house was unoccupied. These country homes are often left unlocked, or with a spare key readily available underneath a flower pot or doormat. It's not difficult to think of ways to enter without smashing windows and drawing attention. You know what this reminds me of, Ronnie?
The Georgia Gargoyle?
Our old friend, the Georgia Gargoyle.
Yeah, a few of our listeners have suggested the Georgia Gargoyle. The Georgia Gargoyle, it was in Savannah?
Savannah, Georgia,
yeah. He was in Savannah, Georgia. And the Gargoyle was operating out of that area for years. I think it was between 85
and 97, right?
Yeah. And his MO was locking himself and his victims in rooms, usually really large rooms like warehouses or auditoriums. I think there was like a public pool in there. The Gargoyle would stockpile all his food and sit upon the great big mound of it, guarding it like a gargoyle, until his victim starved to death. So menacing and fear-invoking was the gargoyle's display that the victims would choose to wait out the ordeal, trying to find a way out, trying to reason with the gargoyle from afar, eventually starving in the process. Little did his victims know that the gargoyle, despite all his appearances and having trapped his victims in with him, did not kill his victims with his own hands. There was no direct attack. If they had tried to eat from the pile, take some food from it, he would have let them. That was his MO, his joy.
His passion. Wasn't he naked when they did those things?
Yeah, that was part of the display. We had a listener who met him once at a conference, and he said that he'd done a lot of home plastic surgery and had made his penis forked like a forked snake tongue. And it had all these air ducts and baffles that he would operate to give it more animation. And apparently it was quite effective.
This might be a good stepping off point to talk again about the angler and what their methods were. You know, one question I have is, was this an individual or multiple people?
Yeah, I think a lot of the evidence points to it being multiple people. What we know about the homes and cabins of those who were killed was that they had many points of access. There were plenty of ways in, plenty of egresses out, and the land surrounding the homes was a hilly topography with plenty of trees and lots of cover, so if someone were to make an escape, they had plenty of routes. And this speaks to the idea that maybe the house was surrounded. If the families thought that they really had no means of escape.
Yeah, but they didn't find any footprints. They didn't find any tracks around the houses that would suggest that these places were being circled or surrounded by assailants.
I just find it hard to believe that one person, even if they had long-range weapons, would be able to keep so many people in one place, especially with so many means of escape.
I mean, fear can be a powerful tool, right? I mean, if this person or persons scared them so badly that they were traumatized and they didn't want to leave the house, that might be enough, right? They would just have to scare them so bad. For instance, you scare someone, scare them a second time, a third time. You do this for a day, day and a half. They think you're out there. At this point, you could probably go home, rest for the night, come back in the morning, scare them again, and they think you've never left. They think you've been there the entire time.
Like you're conditioning them.
Yeah, exactly.
Feel like you're always going to be there whenever they try to escape. You're going to pop out and...
Yeah, an omnipresent threat.
Hmm. It would be a good move. It's worked before, but I feel like the success rate for this is too high. There would be one escapee. There'd be someone who would have survived the incident.
So you're obviously leading towards it being multiple people.
Yeah, I don't see how it could work any other way unless there was a group involved.
I don't know. It could have been one. I mean, look at the gargoyle.
Yeah, but the gargoyle locked himself in with his victims. They had nowhere to go. With this, there was plenty of means of escape.
Yeah, but you're forgetting that some people don't feel like they have means of escape when they're in the woods. Some people feel penned in and claustrophobic by all the trees and hills surrounding them.
I suppose that the angler or anglers could have used the woods to their advantage if the landscape was part of their display of terror, but it'd be very difficult.
I'm leaning towards it being an individual, and the reason I think this is from a clue that we found in the case files that the police originally dismissed as being, you know, inconsequential. They interviewed a neighbor who lived a quarter mile down the road if he had noticed anything suspicious in the week or so prior to the murders. This neighbor said he had a person fly fishing come onto his property the week prior to the bodies being found. And this was odd to him because the angler didn't ask for permission. He simply walked up from the stream and took a drink from his hose. Typically, the people fly fishing will stick to the stream and not risk trespassing at all. They'll typically ask permission if they can enter the stream from his property or exit the stream from his property, but this individual did not do so. In fact, he returned several times over the course of a day to take a drink from the hose. And the neighbor thinks that the angler probably would have kept returning to the house if his German Shepherd hadn't eventually noticed him and started barking, at which point this angler rushed back to the stream and was not seen again by the neighbor.
Though this could be a person casing the neighbor's place, I'm not convinced that it was a singular person. It would make sense that if this person was involved in the crime, that a house with a large animal like a dog would be a deterrent. But the fact that this person was creeping around is not enough to go on that this was the perpetrator of the murders.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems more than coincidental to me.
I mean, it's the only person that we have a record of being in the vicinity. But that's about it.
In our research into this case, we weren't able to find any more evidence that would give us a definitive answer of who perpetrated these crimes and how.
Yeah, I guess it'll just remain a mystery. We decided to visit the locations mentioned. Without any new leads, we traced the tracks that the person fishing would have taken. We put on our waders and stepped into the river. The slippery riverbed made our walking slow. With our attention on our footing as we waded upstream, we almost failed to notice a marking placed on a tree at the edge of the Woodley's property. The bark of a willow tree had been scored. The carvings consisted of two long upright lines and two smaller lines beside them. Each line had a horizontal slash. The four vertical lines seemed to represent the Woodley family, the taller lines the parents and the shorter lines the children. If this interpretation is correct, did the strikes through each vertical line represent their death? We remembered a neighbor had been interviewed and asked by police if he'd seen anything suspicious. The closest neighbor had seen an angler trespassing on his property a few days prior to the bodies being found. Could there be similar markings near his cabin? We backtracked downstream to a house we had seen on the way in. At a wide section of the river, we found a steep meadow leading up to a cabin. On a pine tree near the water's edge was another symbol carved into bark, a single vertical line representing the owner of the house, and a single horizontal line with 4 feet, likely signifying the German Shepherd. However, that symbol had been struck through. After exploring the property, we found a mound of earth with a headstone that read, Kruger, 1998 to 2010. It seemed someone had returned and updated the symbol. We continued down the river, where we found a newly constructed cabin At the water's edge, once again, we found a tree with three lines, two tall and one short, all unstruck. From the cabin, we heard the clanking of pans and the running of the kitchen sink. We smelled bacon cooking. It was Saturday morning.
Well, that's all for this week. Thank you for listening. And as always, we're right outside the window. See ya.
Bye.